Good morning. This is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the August 9th, 2023 in-person meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. This meeting is also being made available via live teleconference for public access. CJ Rhode Island Housing will provide information on this combined in-person and telephonic meeting.
Good morning. This is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for Rhode Island Housing staff, all callers will be muted during the meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, we ask participants to please mute your telephone if you are not speaking. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Kurt Myers speaking. Members of the public can visit the RA Housing website to view today's agenda and information on the actions being taken. If the teleconference portion is interrupted for any reason, we will stop the meeting until audio can be restored. Chairman of the Credit Committee, Kevin Orth, will preside at this morning's meeting. Commissioners and staff, please state your name each and every time prior to speaking. I will turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order.
Thank you, Corinne. This is Kevin Orth. It's now 9:35, and I call the Credit Committee meeting to order and ask that take a roll call.
Commissioner Orth?
Here.
Commissioner Designee Cabral?
Here.
Thank you very much. Would now like to go to the first agenda item. Is this the formal way today?
As you like.
Oh, okay. So we don't need to vote on these things then?
We have a quorum, so if the intention is to recommend the action for approval by the board, we should be taking a vote.
Okay. Great. First item on the agenda is approval of minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on July 11, 2023.
Motion.
And seconded. Great. Any comments on this one?
No.
Okay. Good morning. Stephen, we just started the first agenda item, which is the approval of the mayor.
It's you. I'll be willing to answer to anyone's name in this room.
Take a vote on that. Do you have any comments on
the
minutes or anything?
Okay. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you. Would you please take a vote on this item?
Yes. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on July 11th, 2023, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. With that, the motion is approved. Thank you.
Thank you. Second agenda item is recommendation for approval of the final 2024 qualified allocation plan. So, Anne,
I'm afraid so. Dean is on vacation, so I'm here by myself. So, good morning. This is Anne Berman. So, we had a meeting in July, and following that July Credit Committee meeting, we updated the draft to accommodate the 4 comments the committee had, and as a reminder, those were to include language regarding sponsors demonstrating proactive marketing of these units to households with housing choice vouchers. We added some language under the threshold criteria regarding reasonable cost, which was the replacement for the absolute TDC. And then in the general point category, we elaborated on the sort of the definition of special needs, and we made a note about that elderly does not constitute special needs, and then we elaborated on the requirements for a service plan. So that updated QAP was posted to our website. We e-blasted it to basically everybody we know, and we held a meeting public notice in the newspapers and such. So we did receive written comments and a few comments at the public meeting, which are outlined in the RFA. And as a result of those comments, staff is recommending 3 additional changes, 2 of which are more semantics than substance. The first is it modifies the language in the priority section, and basically individuals and families who are currently experiencing homelessness or have experienced homelessness over the past 24 months to make it a little bit more intentional. In the section on reasonable cost, we changed high end to upper limit of reasonable cost. And then the last change, which is a little bit more substantive, seeks to include the legal costs associated with zoning appeals to either the SHAB or the new, under the new rules to Superior Court, that they would be included as a extraordinary condition and could be deducted from the weighted average unit. Now, lots of people have to do zoning costs, and sort of your standard is not exempt, but anything over and above if there's an appeal, because those things can get lengthy, and we have seen that it can get expensive. So so all of the comments received as of the posting are outlined in the RFA, as I said. The public comment period actually does not end until tomorrow. yesterday, we did receive three additional comments, and we will outline those in the final RFA, but based on our initial review, we don't expect that they will result in any substantive or likely any changes at all. So I wasn't planning to review every comment. We can move forward as you see fit. I'm happy to answer any questions about the comments we did receive.
Great. Thank you very much. That's a motion to approve the recommendation for approval of final 2024 qualified allocation fund.
I'll make a motion.
Great.
I can't second.
I'll second.
We're going to change that, but still.
Okay, got it, got it. Great. Any comments or questions about this one?
Yes.
Yep. Step
up, I may. Did you?
Sorry. No, go ahead.
Mike, a quick question on comment five and the amendment that you spoke of regarding the high-end language.
Mm-hmm.
I see the modified language to say $450,000 per unit represents the upper limit of reasonable cost. What version of cost are we referring to? Are we speaking of purchase cost or production cost or some other variation on cost?
It's total development cost.
Okay. So total development cost at $450 per unit would be the upper limit of reasonable cost. And just that sounds, if you will, reasonable to me, but how did we derive that?
Last year, I think what was being replaced was 429,000, could have been 429 and change. We looked at construction costs that we have seen come through the door in the past 12 to 18 months. We've also, our staff looks at RS means and does sort of a comparison of what's sort of going on in the industry. We get a little granular, and our costs are done by building type. So we have costs for mills and costs for garden style and four-story elevator, four-story non-elevator. And we look at all of those, compare them in means, and sort of try and come up with an average increase that's going on in the industry. And that's essentially how we got to the 450. It's about 5%. In some cases, it's 5. In some cases, it was a little bit higher, but 450 seemed like a reasonable number, particularly in light of the applications that were reviewed and approved in the fall funding round.
Logical question for you. Let's say that there's a development that is more expensive per unit, and you know it serves medically fragile Rhode Islanders. There are features involving folks with handicaps that are expensive, et cetera. Total development cost is higher. The fact that it is beyond this upper limit of reasonable cost doesn't prohibit allocation. It just has to be taken into consideration and an exception has to be granted, or how does that work?
Well, and I think because we no longer, what was eliminated was a absolute threshold that said if you're over this number, you're not, you know, we can't give you credits. And we were, basically, the board was providing waivers under that. So we've eliminated that. And I think in your definition, those are reasonable costs. So it would just get scored and reviewed in the ordinary course of business.
So in short form, forgive me, we were very much part of this process, just to remind ourselves. We have a cap where acceptance were required. Now it's more of a reasonable cost method.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
I know you just said that, but I just wanted to repeat it back.
Correct.
Okay.
Sounds good to me. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Just to follow up on that, there's also a section in the UAP for extraordinary conditions.
Yes.
The cost above that $450,000 for a reasonable amount could fit within one of these extraordinary conditions categories. Is that so? We're not going to allow, oh, I just happened to pay a lot for this property kind of.
No, anything would have to above the upper limit as we know.
Yeah.
would have to have some justification for why those costs are extraordinary or excessive.
And the only thing I would add to that is, in Stefan's definition, if it had, you know, for whatever the required population and its medical equipment, although, you know, if it's assisted living or whatever, I think reasonable is a broad term, so I think we have some flexibility. And I would rather not list everything that would be considered reasonable in the QAP, because then if something, we're not going to account for everything. So I think we have to use our best judgment.
And do you feel that this is enough clarity for the development community with this language? Did you get any comments or anything that it wasn't?
No, the only comments we received were, we're glad you got rid of the TDC cap.
Right, sure.
I think cost containment is still an important national issue for many reasons, and so by keeping this language, we still are consistent with NCSHA best practices.
I'll continue on with. I thought the comments were well considered, and also that the response by staff. So I very much appreciate that. And two, I just want to highlight is the, I think there was a comment about the marketing to units for residents that are the 30% or less AMI. I think that's a very good point. We should be clear what constitutes marketing, so someone knows exactly where they, you know, need to, what they need to do.
Right.
And you said that, but I think that's good. And then again, not to, to beat up too much on it, but this, the services plan, I think we need to be pretty clear about what, who that applies to and what should be included in that. Again, overall, I thought the comments were well put out, as well as the response.
Thank you.
Another comment for me is, it's in the I know the QA as well, so exactly what page it's on. But for the but for these 30% AMI units, it wasn't clear to me, I didn't scour it, but it wasn't clear to me if that is simply income restriction or whether it's income and rent restriction for that. It looked to me like it was simply income restriction.
It's income restriction. I think, if I understand your question correctly, if the unit doesn't have a project-based operating assistance attached to it and the tenant doesn't have a voucher, it has to be the 30% rent. If there is project-based operating assistance to it, it can be consistent with whatever that operating system
will pay,
right? So in the case of HPFELI, it's 50%. In the case of a voucher, it might be higher, given whatever the payment standard is.
Okay.
I think that's
so
fair.
For whatever reason, that project lost that subsidy for that 30%, they would have to drop their rents down to a level that's affordable to someone at 30% AMI.
Well, they right, and in fact, we added language.
They would never be able to afford it.
I just want to be clear.
Right, and we added in big, bold language, the applicant must identify the operating subsidy for these units or use the 30% rent for under.
That's what I saw, and so I thought that's what we're... Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions myself? So, I'm sorry, Seth.
No, no problem at all. No problem. That was good. Comment focuses on the graduation rates.
factor? Just remind us, and how do we take into account measures of school quality and graduation rates overall? Not so much quibbling with the use of graduation rates, as curious, like, what do we do with that data?
We so kind of have two goals in the QAP, right? To ensure that there's housing across all communities across the state, as well as it's a tool for sort of revitalization. And so there's this tension in the QAP between folks that do urban work and folks that do non-urban work. And so throughout the QAP, we're trying to balance those two tensions. The metric used for the graduation rates is posted in KidsCount, and that's what we use, and we actually have a link in the application so folks can go directly to that published annual graduation rate. We had a...
For which purpose, though? I think what you're getting at is something like lower graduation rates signals that there is a greater need for investment in a community, maybe more urban. Is that what you're saying, or something else?
I think it's about areas of opportunity, ensuring that kids have opportunity to go to good schools, and that housing is affordable in communities that offer these areas of opportunity.
Not fully following you. Totally get the notion that these youngsters deserve greater opportunity, rightly. But does it, maybe let me ask it this way. Does it hurt a community that needs affordable housing or is seeking it, or a developer seeking it on its behalf, if their schools are not as good?
Does it hurt? It's a one-point category. And what I would say is that it's part of the balance between a community that might be, they may get points for addressing blighted, foreclosed properties that somebody in a community of area of opportunity wouldn't have. So again, it's part of that balance between urban and suburban.
I would say there are other mitigating factors as well. Again, as Ann said, it's not likely to move the needle between a project getting funded or not funded because it's one point, but it's an acknowledgement that there are resources that certain communities have that others don't, and we should, you know, encourage development in communities of opportunity, just as a rough example. So Providence, if you're doing a project in Providence, which doesn't have the greatest school system, it does have infrastructure, whereas in a rural or suburban community, you may not have the infrastructure, but you have the school system. So it's a way of, you know, looking at the whole picture of where we want to do development and also ensuring that young Rhode Islanders can move to school systems that are successful and have a chance. You know, obviously we know education is the biggest springboard towards future success. And to provide opportunities in non-traditional communities for affordable housing that have good school systems is something that we want to emphasize.
I think hearing this, that those are thoughtful responses, and these are good points. I wonder whether we should rethink this. And I'm wondering out loud, I think there's a very bad signal that we send when we say that if schools are struggling, there is even a slightly lesser chance we'll invest in your community. When, I mean, some of these things are, you know, if families are housing insecure, it affects schooling. So the fact that we're not investing could perpetuate the schools not appearing to perform as well. Now, I'm not, you know, used to work in education. I believe that schools can overcome these barriers. So all these things are nuanced, but I just think there's a tough signal we send when we say, if your schools are worse, we may, at a slight level, have a lesser chance of investing in you. I just think that's really a tough thing, and I wonder whether that point is worth scoring at all. I mean, I'm not insisting on it. It's not my biggest point. It just strikes me, and look, it just strikes me as, you could argue it the other way. You could really argue that poverty and schooling performance are unfortunately still highly correlated. And we certainly shouldn't hold it against you if you have a high poverty level. There are exceptions. There are schools that outperform predictions based on poverty levels, but they're still too rare. You know?
May I offer a legal perspective? So I think you're making an excellent point. It's one that we've worked really hard to address in striking a balance in the QAP. When you take the QAP as a whole and you consider the history of litigation involving QAPs and the allocation of tax credits as between urban centers that need reinvestment and suburbs and areas that are identified by allocating jurisdictions as areas of opportunity, there's a lot of strife and a lot of important and competing factors. And our QAP tries to strike this very careful balance by ensuring that we are giving credit where credit is due to communities that need investment, and that we are also creating new opportunities for people to move to schools that offer children expanded educational opportunity, in addition to other social goods. So we have tried very hard as a way of balancing our own obligations under the Fair Housing Act, not to disproportionately put our resources in one type of community as opposed to another, to ensure that we are speaking to the whole range of potential kind of social goods that this program can confer.
Do you think, though, that, Corey, we, in the fair housing context, we could just as easily, with this provision, open ourselves up to vulnerability, that we are exhibiting bias against lower-income communities that cannot, in most cases, perform against this indicator?
I very much appreciate your perspective on this, but when you think about the case that went to the Supreme Court, the argument was that the Texas allocating jurisdiction was perpetuating patterns of racial segregation by disproportionately citing their credits in urban locations. And what the Supreme Court said is that you have to strike a balance. You have to do things that promote community reinvestment in areas that need it, and you also have to make investments that attract people to move towards different areas of opportunity so that they are no longer closed out.
Is there any other way that we could characterize opportunity other than if your schools are doing poorly, we hold it against you? Is kind of what I'm asking. I follow the argument that our QAP ought to have balance. This way is very unfortunate. I also want to recognize we've got other business to do. Let's not over-index on one point. But I feel like that point is well taken, and still I think this sends a terrible signal. Like, we will hold it against your community if your schools are underperforming.
It's just a tough thing. I think it's not a negative towards, it's just you don't have that additional opportunity to get that one extra point. So it's not taking anything away. It's just giving them more of a point if they have.
Isn't that
no,
the one or the other? I mean, you got to get as many points as you can.
Correct, but it's not removing a point. It's not saying, it's giving a community the opportunity to go for that extra point.
Well, I would love it if the minutes registered my, upon reflection, very strong objections. I think it is a really unfortunate signal, and just as I'm just one person, would request that we take a look at this and see if we can accomplish the same goals without a scenario that invites, God forbid, a community saying, we're doing our best to raise our graduation rates, but please do not make it more challenging for us to get the points necessary to seek housing investment. That would be a terrible thing to ever imagine if we ever were to face that community, or forget about facing it in public. It's just a tough thing to argue, I think.
And I think you raise a very important point. We'll go back and discuss this and look at how this scoring impacts communities that may be challenged based on education, and we have a week anyway before the QAP passes.
Appreciate it.
We'll take a look at it.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah. Thoughtful and good conversation. And I know everyone has the right interests in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I got to weigh too much into that, but I think that the at one point as part of a much broader scoring scheme within the QAP. And the idea, again, is to concentrate lower-income populations. And so we look at not only higher-achieving schools, we look at access to employment, we look at other community amenities. And so there are many of those that Providence or Pawtucket or Woonsocket would score very high in, but they won't be able to get others. And conversely, there are some that Johnston can score in, but they can't get some other ones. So I think it's all thrown into the mix. But I hear what you're saying, but I think if all things being equal, would we rather site an affordable housing property next to a good school or next to a bad school? All things equal, I would go for the better school. But there are obviously a lot of other factors at play that we give points to.
And the only other thing I would mention is we have control over exactly that, right? We have control over where we make investments. And I think Kevin raises a good point about the role of the housing agency to make housing investments versus the role of the state and local community make investments in schools. So I would just raise that as well.
Totally. And I'll just make this one other soft point. If you look at urban graduation rates, I have to look at the most recent stats, but many, many of them are across the whole country, not for an individual school, but a whole system, hover around 50%. They're very poor.
Yeah.
15.
50.
Oh,
5-0. Oh, I mean, not 15.
Right.
For, you know, it's a K to 12 measure of, you know, enrolled early and all the way through to 12th grade with a diploma. It's like something like 50%. It's much, much, much too low. It's the unfortunately still rare exception that a high school, looking at that measure, displays a lot better and can compete with the suburbs. So we really are saying, Kevin, your example is a good one, but when you choose graduation rates, which is a meritorious measure, you're not going to find all that many schools that excel in urban contexts, unfortunately. It's going to be the very rare place in the city where they're going to get that point, right, is my perception. So I just think that's why we should just think about it. I doubt anyone will obsess over it. I raised it quickly and it turned out to be a good conversation. But I do think that you have to be very careful about helping families, children succeed involves housing stability. You know, including the quality of their schooling is affected by it. Anyway, enough said. Sorry about it for a long time.
I think we can certainly take that up maybe at another credit committee meeting. We can talk about the points we give, I guess, for areas of opportunity versus investing maybe in urban areas and just have a broad discussion about it.
Sounds good.
I think that would be
Sounds
great.
Good. That's a smart idea.
Okay. Good. Any other comments or questions on the QAP? No? Okay. Corinne, would you please take a vote?
Yes. This is Corinne Meyer speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of the final 2023 qualified allocation plan, substantial meeting.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion approved by unanimous vote.
Great.
Thank you.
Great work on this QAP. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I think it has evolved beautifully.
I think having the meetings virtually has increased participation, and I think that's a good thing.
Oh, good. That's it for our agenda items.
So we have two discussion items. Yeah. We have our fiscal 2024 budget coming up before
we do.
The board. But I asked if Karen could just go over kind of the financial metrics highlights for us here at the credit committee meeting. Certainly, if you have a question that maybe is outside of that, please ask it, but I'm thinking that's a weird.
Mr. Chair, point of order, this was not listed on the agenda, so if we wouldn't mind taking a vote to add it for informational purposes, that will allow us to dot our I's and cross our T's.
Perfect.
Corinne, would you please take a vote on adding the discussion of the 2024 budget to our agenda?
Absolutely. Is there a motion, please?
I make a motion.
Thank you. And a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion is approved by unanimous vote.
Great. Thank you.
Certainly. This is Carol. I should have.
You should have.
Oh, yes.
Should have.
We've circulated the ratios that Standard & Poor's recommends for us for our rating. Our rating is a AA-. The one that we concentrate on, and S&P also concentrates on a great deal, is the equity to assets, the capital adequacy, making sure that we have enough reserves for the future. So on this spreadsheet, you can see what our June 2023 rating was, 1412, what the budget will be. We're looking at 1326, and then the five-year average. Standard & Poor's looks at our five-year average. They recommend 15%, so we are below their recommended level. Every year they do an analysis of us, and they cite in that analysis that we are below our peers. However, because of our strong asset base, they're not risk-free, obviously, but low-risk loans that we make, that offsets the fact that we don't quite have the right amount of reserves and capital that they are looking for.
So the fact that we have a greater percentage of our loans of FHA insurance?
That's exactly right. Yeah, so on the single-family side, it's the FHA insurance, and the fact that we are now securitizing the loans, so it's got that
right.
Almost like a double guarantee because you've got the FHA insurance and then with Ginnie Mae, we've got that guarantee. On the multifamily side, it's the risk share. So, you know, they count that very highly that we have insurance at least 50% for the majority of our new loans.
This is total equity
assets. That's right. The total equity to assets.
So how does... Can you talk a little bit about the net equity to assets and where that falls?
So the net equity to assets, they don't have a lot of adjustments to it, so it's really just slightly below the total. So where our five-year average on the total is 1479, the net is probably 13%. So they calculate the net, but they don't use that as one of their scoring criteria.
Okay. And I'm just looking over the other HFA S&P rates and think, well, we're higher than New York City.
higher than some, lower than others. It's one comparison. You know, as a state, we definitely might have a different viewpoint on what we do with our income. We are trying to, you know, put the money back into programs, and so that does make a difference to the bottom line. If we spent less on programs, we would have more reserves for those loans, but then we're, you know, not meeting the mission of the organization.
I assume that as we transition to the away from the TBA program and go into, you know, issuing bonds, it's going to impact this.
It's get worse.
To have less income and more assets.
That's exactly right. Or, you know, some income. Our goal is to maintain our income, but the assets will increase as we are doing more bonding. We monitor the TBA market, and, you know, hopefully we will have that opportunity to sell more of our loans. That way our asset base is not increasing at a greater rate than our income. But I think the rating agencies understand that. So, you know, they rate us as an organization, and they also rate each bond issue. So they're very much involved in, you know, what's going on even throughout the year. So they kind of understand that balance.
So on the average of all housing finance agencies, is it always generally that much higher, or is that?
So it depends on the state. Yeah. So there are some states that, you know, they make more money over the 50 years most of us have been in existence. They have built up their reserves.
Is this nationwide or is this a regional number?
It's nationwide. It's not all 50 states. S&P probably does 28 or so, 27, 28 states.
Okay.
And I think the role of HFAs is different in different states, right? We have been the principal housing agency for the state of Rhode Island prior to the chairman, you know, creating his housing department. And frankly, all of our resources went into supporting some of our most vulnerable Rhode Islanders. Now with the housing department, we may reevaluate what our investment strategies are and have that ability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I was just curious. The only reason why I asked was I was just curious if there was a way you could just hone in on, you know, agencies more like
us. Yes.
And the number, I think, would probably
be rare.
More appropriate.
There are certain states that we internally kind of compare ourselves to, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. They have similar programs to us. Their role with the state is kind of similar. And yes, I would say that their numbers are closer to ours. Massachusetts is better on those things. Pennsylvania, we're pretty much in line with what they're doing as well.
Yeah, that's the only takeaway about that, yeah.
So the next ratio is return on assets or profitability of the organization. Again, it's a very similar conversation. Our five-year average is just above what S&P is looking for, but if we don't maintain that net income and our assets continue to grow, that number will go down. And so, you know, we are looking for different strategies such as more selling in the TBA market. To offset some of those negatives.
So we're really looking to go much lower
in this upcoming budget on assets.
So the upcoming budget, we do expect to increase our assets significantly, especially on the multifamily side. We are forecasting that our assets will increase by about $400 million. And so that is why, if you look at the budget column, it's just 0.34% for our return on assets.
And so we will be getting fee income when we issue a lot of these loans.
That's correct.
But in subsequent years, that fee income won't be there, but we'll still have the assets. So it's going to become increasingly difficult to maintain that profit or that return on assets.
It is.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So this could go. So how do we?
It could.
How do we mitigate that?
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is the type of assets that we are adding. As long as the rating agencies are considering them low risk assets, where we're taking all the precautions that we can. We, with our servicing division, we're maintaining low delinquency. Despite the low delinquency, is also a positive for us in our rating. As long as we have other compensating factors, I think we'll be fine. And we do have those conversations with the rating agencies to make sure, is there something else you think are other states doing anything differently? And they have not had those types of comments.
Okay.
Asset quality, the non-performing assets to total loans, very low and well below what their criteria is, and we're actually below our peers, the other HFAs. And then the last question is about liquidity, our loans to asset, and again, the more that we are securitizing our single family loans, that ratio continues to improve, so that should be going down, and that shows that we have more liquidity. We have the ability to sell those mortgage-backed securities if we needed to, as opposed to whole loans that, you know, are not really saleable.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions about this presentation? Great. Thank you very much. And again, we'll have more opportunity to talk about this in the board. This is helpful. This is something I've asked, by the way, for a number of years now. one of my real interests here. So thank you very much. And then we just have another discussion item of the pipeline report.
Right. It hasn't changed dramatically from last month, right? We approved a lot of deals, so staff is working their way through with each of the developers and really, you know, pushing them to the extent we can. You know, I think that there's, in many cases, they're on target. In a couple of cases, we're seeing potential shortage in terms of architects and engineers that is making the delivery of sort of, you know, 50% plans or surveys a little lower, which pushes schedules back. But I haven't seen anything yet that's truly alarming. It's just there's a lot of work in the market. Preliminary conversations with syndicators. I think there's a lot of equity, a lot of credits chasing equity. So some of the equity providers, I think, can be a little bit more selective than others. So I'm not suggesting that's an issue, but it's certainly something that we look at along with pricing. You know, we're cautiously optimistic that the pricing will stay where it is and not drop. We have heard that in other parts of the country it's beginning to the high 80s is more the norm than the exception. But I think in general we're moving everything forward and we expect that most of these projects will hit their targets. We do know of some other projects that are sort of in the works. We've got a few year 15 tax credit deals that are in the process getting ready to apply for credits. We are gearing up for the next RFP. This QAP is a big piece of that. Our goal is to release the RFP by the end of September and receive applications, you know, early to mid-December so that we can hopefully allocate the rest of the ARPA dollars well ahead of the required schedules and continue developing the housing. So my personal hope is that because we received 55 applications last round and funded so many, that pipeline is maybe a little bit smaller. So I'm hoping for my own sanity that we don't get 55 applications, but I wouldn't be surprised if we get 30. So
30 applications.
I can't tell you 30 deals now, but I'm sure there's a bunch of folks that are thinking and are going to put something in, right? Because it's they may see it as sort of the last opportunity for some of these dollars.
Fantastic. Have you been seeing or receiving an increase in inquiries from, I don't know, new developers or existing developers wanting to know how things are working or how they can get
Yeah, I think Dean and I field several of those calls every week. I had a call this morning about what would be a NOAA deal in Little Compton. So, I mean, it's from every community. So people, I think, folks recognize the need for housing, and they're trying to do what they can to,
great,
you know, based on the opportunities, right? We all know what's going on in the market, and those opportunities are less ample than they used to be.
Right. Questions? Comments? Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think that concludes our business then. I have a motion.
All those in favor of adjourning this meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion to adjourn is approved by unanimous vote. Thanks.
Great.